Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When today's guest, Stephen Levitsky, and his co-author, Daniel Ziblatt, wrote their 2017 best-selling book, How Democracies Die, they never imagined that one of this country's major parties would turn away from democracy in the 21st century. They write, "What are the forces that drive a mainstream political party to turn away from democracy? This doesn't happen often, but when it does, it can destroy even a well-established political system. One major problem is that the U.S. Constitution allows partisan minorities to routinely thwart majorities and sometimes even govern them. Institutions that empower partisan minorities can become instruments of minority rule, and they are especially dangerous when they're in the hands of extremist or anti-democratic partisan minorities. The conditions that gave rise to the Trump presidency, a radicalized party empowered by a pre-democratic constitution, remain in place." They write, "We stand at a crossroads. Either America will be a multiracial democracy or it will not be a democracy at all. As the civil rights generation passes into history, the work of building a truly multiracial democracy falls upon us. Future generations will hold us to account." Stephen Levitsky is the David Rockefeller Professor of Latin American Studies and Professor of Government at Harvard University. He's director of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard. He and Daniel Ziblatt wrote How Democracies Die, which was a New York Times bestseller and was published in 25 languages. Their new book is called Tyranny of the Minority. Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's great to have you. I have to say that gave me chills that the work of building a truly multiracial democracy falls upon us. Future generations will hold all of us to account. What a time this is.
Yeah, well, it's been an exhausting, frightening time, but it occurred to us while we were writing this book as we took a step back and looked at the struggle for multiracial democracy which is not new in the United States. It goes back to the early 19th century. There was a major period that we read about in the book during Reconstruction. And then of course the struggle for civil rights over the middle part of the 20th century. The democratizers, the heroes of US democracy in many respects, who brought us the civil rights revolution in the 1950s and 1960s, are sadly passing from the stage. We saw that with the death of John Lewis just recently. And so it occurred to us that, yeah, it's on our generation.
Given all of the work that you and Daniel have done and the research that you've done, looking at so many other countries around the globe and what life was like in those countries when they were dealing with what we're dealing with today. Of course, this is not new also in the United States, but I just wonder all the work that you do, and when you look at the news on a regular basis, whether it's gun violence or racial violence or more abortion bans, book bans, attacks on LGBTQ people, I mean, the list just goes on and on. I'm curious, what kinds of conversations are you having with your colleagues, your family about all of this? What really goes through your mind at this time in our history?
Oh, that's a tough question. You know, there are some things that occur in the United States that, unfortunately bring up, striking parallels to other countries that grew so polarized that parties were not able to overcome their differences, that parties had an incentive, came to a point where they were willing to kill democracy rather than lose an election. There are frightening parallels. There are other things where the United States is really, I don't want to say unique, but pretty distinctive from other countries in the world. In some ways, the United States is growing less democratic even than other contemporary democracies. And there are some ways in which the United States is just different. I mean, the degree of counter-majoritarianism built into our Constitution was far from unique 200 years ago, but it today really stands out in contrast to the rest of the world. So Whether I see contrast between the United States and the rest of the world or parallels kind of depends on the day and depends on the question.
Right. Well, and I'm sorry to ask you such a big question, but we struggle with this. I mean, we've got 5 days to do shows, which sounds like a lot, but we just don't have time. And we think on a regular basis, all right, do we cover those Nazis that we saw so proudly standing in front of Disney World a couple of weeks ago? Or do we talk about the fact that 60% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck? I mean, that, I think people are very overwhelmed by just what's going on in this country, and frankly, just really tired. But as you say, we've got to dig in and do the hard work. We don't really have a choice.
Right. And that is a feeling that citizens, I think, all over the world are feeling, this sort of crushing feeling that of so many problems at once and so many seemingly insurmountable challenges at once. You didn't even mention climate change, which is a big one across the world.
Of course. Right. And we talk about that every Monday on the show, because we knew that after the Hillary Clinton-Trump election that the media would probably not focus on it as much as they should.
Well, I applaud you for that. I think it's also important to, because there's a real danger that people will lose hope, will out of despair sort of give up the struggle to not only to preserve but to deepen our democracy. We have to keep in mind the positives too, right? There are solid majorities in the United States for most of the positions that you just listed, including abortion and gun rights. Those majorities are especially pronounced among younger generations. Resistance to authoritarianism has worked. I mean, it worked in it worked in 2020. Was not a permanent solution. It's never a permanent solution, but we have achieved things here in the United States that where citizens were not so lucky elsewhere.
Mm. Right. And in that section of the book where you focus on abortion, guns, and then poverty and inequality, you point out that if you look at the polling, the majority supports reproductive rights. The majority support basic gun control. The majority support an increased minimum wage and other policies that would actually help people. But because of the way the system is structured, the people are not getting what they want. So given that, how should we be thinking about this? Because it's kind of head spinning. On the one hand, it's hopeful to know where people stand. But on the other hand, people aren't getting what they want. So how should we think about this?
Well, in the book, we argue that we should be thinking of it in terms of our institutions and what can and should be fixed.
Right.
Nobody gets everything they want in politics. Democratic politics is messy. We're often, very often, forced to be content with half a loaf. That's normal democratic politics. You win, you lose, you get some things, you fail to achieve other things you want. But it is true that there is a younger, more college educated, and particularly more urban and secular majority around a certain set of issues that is now pretty systematically being thwarted. And that is, I mean, our institutions are biased in a couple of ways. One is simply biased against majorities. We have a very elaborate system of checks and balances, a very powerful Supreme Court, strong federalism, bicameral legislature, a filibuster in the Senate. So any majority has a difficult time getting its preferences passed. But what has become especially acute in the last couple of decades is the bias towards sparsely populated territories. U.S. rules have always, U.S. electoral and constitutional rules have always favored sparsely populated territories from day one of our Constitution. But that was felt, the impact of that was less salient really for 200 years, in part because both major parties, whatever parties they were, had urban and rural wings. So it didn't seem to have a partisan impact. And the parties weren't very disciplined. And so there were sort of shifting coalitions that allowed different interests to get their way, at least some of the time. Only in the last generation, our politics have been drawn starkly along urban-rural lines. That we, for the first time in history, we have a party that is sort of overwhelmingly based in sparsely populated territory, small towns and rural areas of Republicans, and a party that is overwhelmingly represented overwhelmingly represents urban areas, metropolitan centers. And what that means is that the rules are stacked to favor a party with a rural electoral constituency. And that has made urban interests, the interests of the people in cities, often more educated and or non-white, it's meant that they have been sort of systematically thwarted policy-wise more than they ought to be. And again, one of the things we point out in the book is that rural overrepresentation has been common throughout the world. This sort of extreme counter-majoritarianism used to be widespread in the world. The U.S. didn't really stand out 200 years ago. In fact, we were a democratic pioneer. We weren't a full democracy. We were a democratic pioneer when the Constitution was first written. But over the course of literally a couple hundred years, but certainly the last century, other democracies in the world, in Europe, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and really across much of Latin America as well, have dismantled or weakened many of their most extreme counter-majoritarian institutions. So they've become more sensitive to electoral majorities. They have empowered electoral majorities to actually govern. And that's something that we've done that to some extent. We started directly electing the Senate in the early, about 100 years ago. We obviously expanded the franchise, and we ended severe malapportionment in the House in the 1960s. But we've now got the most counter-majoritarian set of institutions on earth, and we've fallen pretty dramatically behind many other democracies.
I want to share just one fact that stood out in that portion of the book. And this is about the Senate. In 1790, a voter in Delaware, the least populous state, had about 13 times more influence in the Senate than a voter in the most populous state, Virginia. In the year 2000, by contrast, a voter in Wyoming has nearly 70 times more influence in the Senate than a voter in California.
Yep. And that that has always been, I mean, the problem got much, much worse in the 20th century. There's always been a bias in favor of citizens in states like Vermont and Wyoming and North Dakota, and against voters in places like California and Texas. But now it's increasingly taken on a partisan hue because the party that represents the most of the sparsely populated territories is the Republicans, and the party that represents most of the more populated territories, not all of them, is the Democrats.
Right. Let's talk about how the U.S. stands out. You write that we're seeing far right parties gain ground in many countries around the globe. In nearly every Western European country, between about 10% and 30% of the electorate, disproportionately white and less educated voters who live in declining regions or outside urban centers, is open to xenophobic appeals. And everywhere from the UK and France to Italy, Germany, and Sweden, these voters have boosted the electoral fortunes of far-right parties and movements. And yet the U.S. stands out in a couple of ways. So let's talk about this. First, you write, the reaction to growing diversity has been unusually authoritarian in the United States. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, there is, a couple of things. First of all, it may be that the U.S. is simply ahead of the curve because all Western industrialized democracies are growing more diverse. European countries are becoming dramatically more diverse over the last in recent decades, but none have reached the the point where the United States is, where a long dominant ethnic majority is sort of staring at losing its majority status and its dominant status. So the U.S. Is simply more diverse than other democracies, other Western democracies. And the sort of founding majority arguably perceives itself as more threatened than in other cases. So that may be the reason. That's one difference. The other difference is simply that our institutions empower the, so there is a party that represents, as you said, mostly white, mostly more religious, rural, less educated sectors who are more likely to move in a reactionary direction in a context of growing inequality and growing diversity. But in other countries, the party that represents those folks has not been able to govern alone. U.S. isn't unique, but it's one of the very few countries where this sort of reactionary parties actually come to power by itself. I don't have a definitive answer for you as to why the U.S. Republican Party appears to be more authoritarian than far right parties in Europe. Not everyone agrees that that's true. There are many who would argue, and I think we just don't know, that if many of these parties say that the National Rally, we used to be the National Front in France, if they actually were to come to power, that they would behave similarly. I don't think we know. But empirically, it is the case that the Republicans over the last 10 or 15 years have behaved in a more openly anti-democratic direction than far-right parties, most far-right parties in Europe. There are a couple of, you know, basically fascist parties, the Golden Dawn in Greece, that are equally authoritarian. But far-right parties in Europe haven't, to date, refused to accept the results of elections, have not sort of appeared to condone or even encourage political violence in some cases. You don't see that across the board in far-right parties, like you've seen in the last decade in the Republican Party. Now, again, why and whether that will continue or whether other far-right parties will sort of catch up to the United States, I don't think we know yet.
You know, reading your book, I have to wonder how much race plays a role in the answer to that question.
Well, I think it plays a huge role. And, you know, race is an issue now in virtually every Western democracy. Not every Western democracy has a history of slavery that the United States has. And there's a lot of evidence, a lot of recent scholarship that shows that we are still, as a society and as an electorate, feeling the impact of slavery, the end of slavery, and Reconstruction. That whites living in areas that had slavery and that experienced the end of slavery, Reconstruction, tend to be considerably more racially conservative than whites living elsewhere. So there's pretty good evidence that our legacies of slavery make exacerbate the problem.
Right. Our legacies of slavery. And then the way that you all write about what happened under Obama, I mean, it's pretty breathtaking when you think about it. You write, "Obama's presidency made the transition to multiracial democracy plain for all Americans to see. The mere presence of an African-American family in the White House, displayed on TV screens day after day, made the new demographic and political realities impossible to ignore. Many white Americans feared that the country they had grown up in was being taken away with that, away from them."
And that's what I mean when I say the United States may just simply be some years ahead of European democracies. European societies are also becoming much, much more diverse, much more multiracial. Mm-hmm. And we're beginning to see non-white leaders. We have a non-white prime minister in the UK, obviously. So whether the US is sort of qualitatively different or whether the US is just a decade or so ahead of other countries, I think is still to be seen.
You have so much history in the book about whites in power and how the demographic of this country changed And then the section on white Christian nationalism, I think, is really interesting. I wonder what you think about media coverage specifically of this, because I feel like many in the media are still afraid to use the word fascism. Well, many people in general are afraid to use that word. We did a show about fascism, and some of our listeners said, I'm just not comfortable using that word. And I think the same might apply to Christian nationalism.
In that people don't want to use the term Christian nationalism?
Right. I just don't, because I don't think they know what to do with it, to tell you the truth. I mean, I'm hearing still on NPR, the basic person on the street interview. Let's go to the diner and put a mic in front of a Trump supporter and say, why do you support him? And that's it. They don't really ask the deeper questions like, well, what do you think about the child separation or the racist comments coming out of his mouth? It's like we're back at 2014.
Yeah, you may be right. This is beginning to get a little further outside of my area of expertise, but I'm very struck actually by the guy in the diner phenomenon, because it tells us that even, you know, that most of us still at some level treat basically the white guy as the prototypical American. Like when a politician or even mainstream media figures say the words average American or try to interview the average American, it's a white guy. And that has real consequences, because it elevates the status, the moral standing, and ultimately the political standing of the guy in the diner. Like, why is the guy in the diner more typical than a bus driver in Los Angeles? It's not clear to me, but that's a very, very powerful effect. So not only is our electoral rules are biased to favor the guy in the diner, at least if the guy in the diner lives in a underpopulated state, but our public discourse and our national sense of exactly who is an American, I think it's changing, but it's still got that bias. And you see that every time reporters rush to those diners in Ohio.
Exactly. And I not to keep going on this point, because like you said, this is not what you're writing about, but I find it fascinating. I think that the media, the major media, really struggle with all of this, because as you write in the book, the Trump presidency left the Republican Party deeply immersed in white resentment politics. Many Trump supporters are embracing the great replacement theory, which claimed that a cabal of elites was using immigration to replace America's, quote, native white population. And the question is, you know, how should the media deal with this? Because I think that's just a really important media question. We're going to take just a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Stephen Levitsky, the David Rockefeller Professor of Latin American Studies and Professor of Government at Harvard University. In 2017, he and Daniel Ziblatt wrote How Democracies Die, which was a New York Times bestseller and was published in 25 languages. Their new book is called Tyranny of the Minority. They write, "We stand at a crossroads. Either America will be a multiracial democracy, or it will not be a democracy at all. As the civil rights generation passes into history, the work of building a truly multiracial democracy falls upon us, and future generations will hold us to account." This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. In 2017, they wrote the best-selling book, How Democracies Die. It was published in 25 languages. In their new book, they wrote, "Understanding how we got here is the principal task of this book. The more urgent question is how to get out. One thing is clear. Our institutions will not save our democracy. We will have to save it ourselves." Stephen Levitsky is the David Rockefeller Professor of Latin American Studies and Professor of Government at Harvard University. He also directs the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard. Let's talk a little bit more about the section on your book about white Christian nationalism. You write, not only did the Republicans' white Christian base radicalize in the face of a perceived existential threat, it effectively captured the party. So given all the research that you've done, what did you come up with about how this happened?
Well, I should say, as you noted, I study Latin America for a living. So I had to rely, I'm not an expert on voting patterns or parties in the United States. So we had to do a lot of homework. We drew very heavily on research done by our colleagues who spent decades studying American politics. And what we found is it's a very long-term process. This is not a problem that emerged overnight. Basically, two things happened slowly since basically 1964, 1965. First of all, the Republican Party, if you go back 50 years, 60 years, was very much the minority party in the United States. During the New Deal era, the Democrats were the dominant party. And the Republicans spent a lot of time, particularly in the 1950s and 60s, doing what political parties do, trying to figure out how to become the majority party. That's what parties do in a democracy. And the civil rights revolution and the civil rights movement of the 50s, and then the judicial rulings and the legislation of the 1960s created an opportunity for the Republicans. The Republicans traditionally had been the party of civil rights. They were the party that gave us Reconstruction. They were the good guys in 19th century politics of race, whereas the Democrats had been traditionally much more opposed to civil rights. But that gradually changes. And after 1964, 1965, gradually, slowly but surely, the Democratic Party becomes the party that's associated in the public's mind with civil rights. And when that happens, African-Americans gradually flock to the Democratic Party. And Southern whites, who had been overwhelmingly Democratic for generations, get angry, get frustrated. Their party was pushing a civil rights agenda with which they were uncomfortable. And the Republicans saw that. They started seeing it in the 50s. They saw it, or some of them, not all, they debated, not all Republicans wanted to go this way, but some Republicans saw an opportunity in the South. They saw voters who were available for a new appeal. And that is what Goldwater did when he explicitly ran for president in opposition to the Civil Rights Act. And that is what Nixon did via the Southern strategy, which is not opposed to the Civil Rights Act, but opposed key government policies aimed at implementing, at achieving racial equality, busing, affirmative action, and the like, particularly busing. And explicitly appealed the Republican Party, really for about 20 years, explicitly appealed to whites who were uncomfortable with the implementation of the Civil Rights Revolution, basically. And they succeeded. They succeeded to the point where in the 1980s and the 1990s, the Republicans, they very gradually, the South goes from being Southern whites, go from being overwhelmingly Democrats to being overwhelmingly Republicans. And that shift of Southern whites transformed the Republicans into a majority party under Reagan. They finally captured the House under Newt Gingrich in the 1990s. And so over the course of 30 years, the Republicans bring into their fold white voters who are particularly conservative on race. But another thing happens. The United States becomes more diverse. Not only do we take steps towards racial equality starting in 64, 65, but we become a much more diverse country, thanks in large part to immigration. And so the Republicans became basically America's white Christian party, which was a very successful strategy in the 1980s and 1990s. But as the electorate grew more diverse, that became an increasingly problematic strategy. Problematic in two senses. First of all, being America's white Christian party in the 21st century did not guarantee you electoral success. In fact, it was increasingly an electoral problem. Republicans had a harder and harder time winning national elections. Just to give you one example, in 1980, Ronald Reagan won 55% of the white vote. The Republicans have won the white vote in every single presidential election since 1960, after 1964, starting in 68. Every single presidency, they always win the majority of white voters. In 1980, Reagan winning 55% of the white vote was sufficient for a landslide election over Carter. 32 years later, if I'm getting my math right, Mitt Romney wins 59% of the white vote, does even better than Reagan among whites, but loses the election to Obama. So being a white Christian party, being the party of white voters was no longer enough. And so that's one challenge for the Republicans. The other challenge is that they had spent a generation or more bringing distinctively racially conservative whites into their fold. Those voters didn't respond very well to the rise of multiracial democracy. Those voters tended not to be huge fans of immigration. Those voters tended to be the ones who responded negatively to, say, an African-American family in the White House. And they, rather than being kind of spread out between the two parties, as was historically the case, they're now really concentrated in the Republican Party. And they become a primary winning plurality. There are different measures of, you know, how much – obviously not all Republicans are Christian nationalists. Not all Republicans are racially conservative. But Donald Trump showed, made it very, very clear that there are enough of them that a really sort of white nationalist appeal can win you a primary in the Republican Party. So it's at least a primary winning plurality of the Republican Party. And that is the root of the party's radicalization.
Right. So obviously they're not all in line with this, but you've got people like Stuart Stevens, who you quote in the book a couple of times, who is basically a never Trumper. And he's really had many deep moments of sharing how he got a lot wrong. He basically said, I now realize how racist my party is. He said, I just didn't realize it. What about the people who, though, are still in the party? I mean, what I find fascinating is they've been able to bring together such a wide coalition. You've got the Christian nationalists. You have the people whose only goal is to make sure that abortion is illegal in every state in this country. But then you have the wealthy tax cut Republicans on Wall Street who are probably pro-choice and might not like all of these anti-LGBTQ laws, but they want their tax cuts and they don't want regulation. So what do you think explains the people who are still part of the party, who are not fighting back against these very racist elements?
I mean, a couple of things. First of all, I neglected in my overly long answer before to mention another important dimension, which is the religious one. In appealing to discontented whites, particularly in the South, and especially in the 1980s, this was Reagan's innovation. The Republicans also appealed to evangelical Christians. So evangelical Christians had been evenly distributed between the two parties. A majority voted for Jimmy Carter over Reagan. But by the 21st century, they're overwhelmingly Republican. So the broader point, though, Rose, is that we're obviously a very big, heterogeneous, very diverse country on a number of fronts. And whether it's religion or region or ideology or views on economics or views on foreign policy, we're a diverse country, big, diverse country. We have two political parties. So that means that by necessity, inevitably, both political parties are going to be pretty heterogeneous. They're going to include a bunch of different groups whose priorities are different, whose identities are different, whose priorities and goals are different. And so there are some in the party, as you say, who have certain kind of religious based priorities, and for whom, whether it's gay rights or whether it's traditional values or whether it's abortion, that's what they care about, and everything else is less important. Those folks you expect are probably going to still be Republicans, even if they don't care very much about the race issue. And then, as you said, there are traditionally many, many, many Republicans who are there for the tax cuts, who are basically free marketeers, who may be pro-choice. They may or may not care about race and religious issues, but they really care about economic issues. And they have been, many of them have been voting Republican their whole lives. So a couple of things. I mean, the this final group, what I like to call Romney Republicans, they are leaving the party. It takes a while in the United States for people to switch parties. People do not, people have pretty entrenched partisan identities. Often they grew up as a member of a party, and it's not very common for someone just to say, oh, I'm sick of this party, I'm joining the other one. Just it happens very gradually. People start calling them independents, themselves independents. Very, very few people flip from one party to another. It's a slow process, but that process is happening with the Romney Republicans, the sort of upper middle class, suburban, college educated Republicans who care about taxes and regulation, but not so much about social issues. They are leaving, and they're just leaving somewhat slowly, as always happens.
So, you know, speaking of leaving the party, it was very interesting to read this. I hadn't read this before. You write that before departing the White House, Donald Trump reportedly told the RNC chair, Ronna McDaniel, that he planned to leave the GOP and form his own party, a party that was committed to democracy, would have parted ways with a leader who had just attempted a coup. But the RNC, desperate to keep Trump, threatened to stop paying his legal bills and withhold his campaign email list unless he stayed. And most leading Republicans, including Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy, said they would support him if he were the party's future nominee. That was just fascinating to read, that he actually said he was going to leave and form his own party.
Yeah, I mean, well, he didn't take that very far, but that scenario could reemerge. Donald Trump, we all know, is in it for Donald Trump. He doesn't give a damn about the Republican Party. If the Republican Party is useful to him, as it has been in recent years, he will use it. If the Republican Party were to turn against him or to threaten his interests, he would, use every weapon available to him to punish the Republican Party. He is, if there's one thing we know about Donald Trump, it's that he is a total opportunist. And so Trump has a lot of voters, and the great leverage that he has and has had since 2016 is this threat to walk away. Donald Trump could walk away from the Republican Party and run a third party bid. We have no idea, or I have no idea, exactly how many votes he would get. He probably wouldn't win. He almost certainly would not win, but he could credibly threaten to destroy the Republican Party's chances in any election, right? He would take enough people with him if he were to take his ball and go home and run a third party candidacy to guarantee that the Republicans badly lose the next election. Mm-hmm. And the Republican Party would rather win elections. It pains me to say this, but they showed in that incident that they'd rather win elections than, defend U.S. democracy. And so they, if this primary gets tight and there's a contested primary and Trump somehow were to begin to lose, you can bet that he would begin to sort of threaten disruption in this way.
Mm. This is really important because, and you've touched on this in the last book, in Tyranny of the Minority, right? When mainstream parties tolerate, condone, or support anti-democratic extremists, it sends a powerful message that the cost of anti-democratic behavior has been lowered. The deterrent effect evaporates. Semi-loyalty does not just normalize anti-democratic forces, it encourages and may even radicalize them. And I think, Steve, what's so scary about this is, I mean, we're talking about violence that is actually happening. I mean, I think about the election workers or the librarians or people who are just doing such important work in this country and are now receiving death threats as a result of all of this.
Yeah, no, I mean, the U.S. is in part because of the level of anger and polarization in the country, but also because of to the sheer number of guns out there, the U.S. is at risk for, I'm not sure that I buy the argument that we're at risk for civil war, but we are at risk for a pretty dramatic increase in political violence. And we've already seen it, as you said. International democracy indices in organizations like Freedom House that measure try to measure the level of democracy in each country has downgraded the United States considerably. So according to Freedom House, which is a US-based mainstream, I would say center, even center right leaning NGO, now classifies the United States as less democratic than Argentina. We have a lower freedom score than Argentina. And you pointed to some reasons why. When election workers face threats to their lives, that directly affects the level of democracy in a country. Election workers don't face threats to their lives in Argentina. And nobody challenges the results of elections in Argentina.
And then this is so important, and you talk about this a lot. During the 2022 primary season, the New York Times found more than 100 Republican TV ads in which candidates brandished or fired guns. You write, "We can think of no other major party in any contemporary Western democracy in which candidates so openly embrace violence."
Yeah.
And that's amazing, given all the research that you two have done.
And we were talking earlier about ways in which the United States reminds me of other countries, and it doesn't. One way, as you know, the United States is really pretty different from a lot of rich democracies is the centrality of guns in at least part of our culture. Guns don't play the same role in British or Japanese or South Korean or German or Swedish society.
So we've got 5 minutes left here, and I want to just make sure we end on a note what to do about this. And you have a long list of what it will take to stop this and ensure that majorities win power and govern. So I'll just mention a couple, and then you can leave us with some parting thoughts about what it will take to get there. So we're talking about very basic voting rights to ensure that people have the right to vote. Maybe can we vote on the weekend? And then another one to reflect majority preferences. This is the one I think about a lot, especially as we're going into a presidential election next year, is to abolish the Electoral College and replace it with a national popular vote. How do we get to these places? I mean, we think about this a lot, but the Electoral College, I just keep thinking about that.
Well, the two areas that you just mentioned are areas where the United States is really pretty unique. Most modern democracies have include the right to vote in the Constitution. We do not have a constitutional right to vote. We have a constitutional right not to be discriminated based on race to the right to vote. We do not have a universal constitutional right to vote. And that would help as a protection against initiatives that make it harder to vote across, which we've seen across the country over the last 10 or 15 years. So that's a pretty straightforward reform. It seems, for me, it's pretty difficult to oppose the right to vote. The Electoral College is also distinct. Once upon a time, there were a number of countries in the world that had some sort of indirect election for president. Either Congress would elect the president or you'd have an Electoral College. Every other presidential democracy on earth has eliminated its Electoral College and replaced it with direct elections. Argentina was the last one to jettison its Electoral College in 1994. And so only in the United States, among presidential democracies, can the loser of the popular vote actually win the presidency. Now, there have been hundreds of efforts to abolish the Electoral College. It obviously requires a constitutional amendment. We came very, very close in the late 1960s. President Nixon supported it. The leaders of both parties supported it. It passed the House pretty overwhelmingly. And so it's not crazy to think about eliminating the Electoral College, but constitutional amendments, unfortunately, in the United States are extremely difficult. It should be hard to change the Constitution, but the United States, among the world's democracies, has the hardest constitution to change.
I also didn't know that the U.S. is the only democracy in the world with lifetime tenure for Supreme Court justices. All other established democracies have either term limits, a mandatory retirement age, or both.
Right. So justices are supposed to be independent. They're supposed to have 10-year security. Their terms should definitely last longer than the presidents who appoint them. But the judiciary is a very counter-majoritarian institution, right? Judges don't have to respond to majority sentiment at all. And that's correct. But I think there's a limit that once justices who were appointed generations ago are making decisions that affect contemporary majorities, you enter in this realm that we call intergenerational counter-majoritarianism, which we think is excessive.
In our remaining minute, in order to get there, it's going to take a lot of education. People need to talk about all of this, join groups, organize, and then, as you write in the book, continue creating mass movements.
Yeah, democratic change does not come easily, and it doesn't come quickly, unfortunately. We write about the women's suffrage movement, which struggled for, nearly a century, decades and decades, more than half a century before achieving the suffrage. The civil rights movement was a long struggle with wins and losses and setbacks, but it's a democratic reform is a long process. And yeah, it requires that citizens organize. It requires movements. And I personally think that the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020, which by most counts that I've seen were the largest set of protests in the history of the United States, were fundamentally a movement about multiracial democracy. And I think that is kind of gives us a picture of the kind of movement that could be. It was a multiracial movement. It was mostly young. It was all over the country. It was small towns and cities. And it was a picture of the multiracial democracy that we could be.
Stephen Levitsky is professor of Latin American studies and professor of government at Harvard University. In 2017, Steve and Daniel Ziblatt wrote How Democracies Die, a New York Times bestseller that was published in 25 languages. Their new book is called Tyranny of the Minority. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thanks again, Steve, for joining us. Thanks for your important work, and we'd love to have you back.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.